of the not only the analytical aspect, but sort of the revolutionary, as you alluded to, Dr. Strosky, want to get an understanding too of how has this theory, you know, informed our understanding and even enhanced the experiences of our sort of social interactions and the college athlete experience? How has this tool or this framework been able to illuminate some of those positives from its examinations?
Yeah. Well, I think foundationally, the more that we can understand about how this system works and how it has historically worked. And also, you know, one of the ways that systemic racism perpetuates itself is that taken for granted policies and practices, just the way we do business, that people perpetuate things that they don't really understand. Unless light is really shown on what's going on. So, and I think this is really an incredibly interesting moment to think about in light of the opportunities that have become available as a result of the social media age and the ability for athletes and for marginalized people who have been associated with the college sports system to be able to organize in safe places outside of the structure, to be able to influence it and to push back against it. Dr. Carter Franciek and Dr. Hawkins, both of you and some of the people who are on the call today, you've worked looking at HBCUs, and you've looked at that critical moment in the 1960s when the NCAA started to integrate. And it's really important to understand how the controls over players were really getting implemented in that critical 1960, early 1970 timeframe. And that there's even a regulation still on the books today called the Fraudulent Misrepresentation Rule, where an athlete who does not show up to practice can lose their scholarship as a result of that. And of course, all of that came out of protests in the 1960s. Schools are less likely to fully implement that rule because of all of the public pushback that they might get if an athlete were to divulge that on social media. And so, you know, we've got this very interesting dynamic that's going on, but fundamentally, we still have that rule on the books that needs to be taken off. And that's, I think, sort of this tension around how do we proceed to make progress. The other part of this, though, I think, is the crying need for transparency and accountability. This system has been able to operate because it has not been held accountable, and there has not been external entities that have required it to be transparent and accountable. And so I think that as we have groups that are mobilizing as watchdog groups, I think we're seeing more and more of this call for transparency, but we still need these independent entities that we don't have right now. That are desperately needed to keep us moving forward.
Ooh, I'm like, I'm taking notes. But I think, you know, what both of you have positioned and sort of situated is helping us understand the role of tradition, the role of this is how it's always been done, and how this notion of transparency really needs to come to the fore because of how the interests have been converged. So we're moving into that space right now, a little hint. And as I go into expressing a few views on that, our audience members, please feel free to share your questions and put them in the Q&A, and we'll get to those after our panelists have answered a couple more questions, okay? Again, put those questions in the Q&A box. So, you know, as I alluded to, in the beginning, and Dr. Stroman did as well, CRT does have those five tenets, again, generally speaking, right? From counter narrative, which many of us have used, intersectionality, which is my wheelhouse, and whiteness as property have all been used to really explicate and really the lived experiences of Black athletes. At this moment, interest convergence has great relevance as we acknowledge the past year and a half with the confluence of COVID-19 and the resurgence of Black Lives Matter movement. Even more so when we talk about the tenet of interest convergence and how it originated out of the work of Dr. Bell, right? He argued, of Derrick Bell, he argued that the Brown case, Brown versus the Topeka Board of Education, which is the city and state and that I was born and raised in, and whose parents were actually brought to that state to help continue live out the manifestation of that legislation. Based on that Brown versus Board case, in which some of you may know, many of you do, for those of you that don't, I'll give a little aside, in which the Supreme Court outlawed de jure segregation of public schools, was not a moral revelation of the court, but a response of necessity. Looking at the work of Milner, McGee, and Perlman, they suggest that the decision was rooted in three ideals. One, to advance American Cold War objectives in which the US was competing with the Soviet Union for loyalties of the Third World. Two, to quell the threat of domestic disruption that was a legitimate concern with Black veterans who now saw continued discrimination as a direct affront to their service during World War II. And three, to facilitate desegregation in the South, which was now viewed as a barrier to the economic development of the region. They further suggest that the interests of the Black civil rights movement coincided for a brief time with the interest of white elites, thus enabling a decision that benefited the interests of Black people. Or as Derrick Bell stated, the interests of Blacks in achieving racial equality will be accommodated only when it converges with the interest of whites. So that's a lot to say. But as we consider that, Dr. Starowski, you as a social justice expert, you know, what issues have come to the fore during this time period for athletes of color and their intersecting identities with as it relates to their ethnicity, their nationality, their gender, their sexual orientation and expression?
Well, I'm just that slice of the description, you know, we could spend days just unpacking all of that, right? Here are just a couple of things that that I'm sorting through, especially around that issue of intersectionality. During the same window of time when we've seen a mobilization around state legislatures proposing and passing laws in terms of CRT, what we've also seen is we've seen state legislators passing laws around transgender athletes. And I think from a racial perspective that it's really important to really recognize that Black women in particular have been the figures that have created the fear around fairness and athletic participation for women, that the whole framing of this discussion as something around fairness really emanates out of concerns about Castor Semenya, Du Tayshaund. We have these two transgender female athletes from Connecticut, African-American female athletes from Connecticut, who are constantly cited as the source of concern in terms of regulating the women's athletic space. I think that this is one of the biggest issues in terms of really understanding how all of these systems of oppression nest together in a way that slows down progress for everyone, right? So I've taken way too long to explain that, but that dynamic is really deeply troublesome. And it's not accidental that CRT is and attacks on CRT are happening in the same time frame and in tandem with each other, I think. So I'll just lay that out as something for people to think about that, but that's one big piece for me.
There's a host of issues, you know, that we're seeing. Again, you've laid those out quite beautifully when we talk about the intersectionality of those individuals and how they manifest. Again, transgender issues are definitely at the fore of many conversations, and the experiences of Black female athletes. I know we've got Dr. McGarry on the call. She was one of those that influenced me and sort of getting my work out there as well. As we think about those experiences, and again, think about the concept of entrance convergence, in this moment, Dr. Hawkins, how does the tenet of entrance convergence manifest for Black athletes? What are the issues and challenges that we sort of see occurring?
I think one of the things when you look at the racial demographics, and again, I go back to the whole notion of if Black lives matter anywhere, it matters in Power Five basketball and football. And just looking at the numbers, one of the things I find amazing is the public service announcement that the NCAA often uses. I haven't seen it this year, but I'm waiting for it. About over 488,000 or whatever the number is has escalated to go pro in something other than professional sports. Well, the interesting thing about that number is that less than 1% of that 488,000 generate 90% of the NCAA's revenue. Okay. And of that 1%, over 60% of that labor force are Black males. You know, so I think when we talk about interest convergence, I think, and this is where I like to see it as moving to a revolutionary theory. If Black athletes just take the Final Four last year and look at Gonzaga, UCLA, UH, and Baylor. Baylor and UCLA had over 71% of their team African-American male. Gonzaga, of all places, had 50% African-American males, which I was astounded. Anyway, UH had 87%, which, okay, we're in one of the most diverse cities, and we live in housing in the third world. That's acceptable. And again, it generated over $840 million and during a pandemic. So we have here over 60% of this labor force, this $800 million being African-American males, you know. And I think when Black males begin to recognize their position and how they undergird this operation, they can begin to make some demands and I think push the needle. Looking at the college football playoffs, again, similar pattern, Alabama, Georgia, you know, schools like Ohio State, all predominantly Black males. I don't even want to think about starters. Okay. And time played points, you know, that's a whole nother in support of how Black labor is undergirding this operation. So with that said, I think, you know, it goes back to the quote you made by Derrick Bell, the interests of Blacks in achieving racial equality will only be accommodated when it converges with white interests. Well, we can force white interests, right? Because capitalists are moved by the fear of market disruption or work stoppage. And if that is the case, then understanding that nothing will happen from a capitalist point of view, from a moral standpoint, or from an altruistic judgment, they're going to be moved by market disruption or work stoppage. So then Black athletes can make demands. You know, they can make demands again in order to, because again, the interest is for them to maintain a viable system, right? Economic system. So I think then when you think about, one of the things I find amazing is when you talk about NIL legislation, I'm like, there's one L that's missing. You know, name, image, and likeness are good, right?
Hello, yeah. This is your team.
I'm sorry. There's labor is missing. you know, because not only do we see the name, image, and likeness exploited, I have seen it exploited, but their labor has been exploited the most. And I see this in some small ways. I look at, take for example, coaches' salaries, and I look at APR bonuses. I look at GPA bonuses, graduation rate bonuses. And I'm thinking, this again, this is economic exploitation, because I haven't seen a coach enter into my classroom taking a test or, you know, trying to, you know, increase the GPA. I know they're supposedly over this operation and encourage student athletes to attend class, do good, study, and all of that. But again, we see this economic exploitation, right? And this academic exploitation off of this whole, this labor piece. So I'm thinking that Black athletes, you know, will come into the consciousness of their power, right, of this exploitation in many different levels, right, not only name, image, and likeness, but labor, and begin to make some of these demands, whereas a percentage of, why we can't have a percentage of, you know, those bonuses distributed to the athletes that are actually doing the work, you know. So this is where I can see, this is where I see and hope that, you know, this whole notion of interest inversion can push towards this being this revolutionary theory.
Dr. Ellen, I come to you because I'm seeing some head nods and wondering, you know, what is your take on that same question as well? You know, where do you see this the role of interest convergence sort of manifesting in this space? I saw a lot of head nods with the labor. I'm over here agreeing again, as I was a former student athlete. My brother was a former college athlete at Florida. My husband was a college athlete at LSU, been on the coaching side as well. We've seen those lived experiences. We've lived those experiences as Black athletes in that and serving as a labor force. What are some other things that you see or continuation of the thoughts on labor?
Yeah, I couldn't keep my enthusiasm in check, right? I broke out in applause because the word of the day was said, which is labor, right? You know, this system has been denying that it has a labor force, you know, for over 75 years, even as they understood that they had created an employment relationship. So I think that that having this foundational understanding that all of this discussion is about controlling a labor force and controlling its movement, controlling the decision making around it, controlling its value, building entire industries on that labor. I would also encourage people who are really interested in really thinking about dramatic change within the college sports system to go beyond just thinking about the NCAA and the conferences in terms of the entities that have an economic investment in this. ESPN, if effectively built its enterprise on the labor of the 1% that Billy's talking about. You know, ESPN didn't get those 10 channels and an omni digital presence, you know, through its affiliations with professional sport. It did it through college sport. And it's, you know, not only has it done that, but it's actually brought everything back in-house to suppress additional labor by having colleges and universities provide cheap labor in terms of the production of games now. You know, so the hegemonic system keeps working to figure out ways to increase profit while suppressing labor cost and to suppress the fact that it actually has labor underneath all of this. So that's one thought I have about this. You know, working with the National College Players Association, we took on this narrative around 95% of all NCAA athletes are going to go pro in something else. And, you know, underneath all of that is a denial that athletes have value now in the moment. And for many of them, their highest earning power is happening while they are in college. So they're being denied that value And then generationally, when we connect that to the denial in terms of generational wealth, it gets into billions and billions of dollars. If we think that if we just play out, you know, just a very quick scenario, if you just take an athlete whose value is at $250,000, which for, you know, a Division I football player with just some basic analysis shows that that's probably what their value could be. And you translate that out over 10 years, you know, at a 6% rate. You're looking at billions of dollars that athletes are losing out on that then connects to generational wealth and all of the other attendant things that go along with it. So this understanding that this is about labor cannot be underestimated. I would also say that a lot of the fears around the system are these cries that the system is going to go under, that people aren't going to watch, that they're not going to support it. You know, there's really no foundation for that. There's always been an audience for young people who are competing, at the height of their youth, right? There's still going to be a narrative to be sold there. So I could go on, but those are just some of the things I think that are important to kind of wrap our minds around as we begin to attack the system and figure out ways to change it substantially.